afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the New York State Decision Center Collaborative Conference Call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Anne Wendland. Ms. Wendland, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Kelly. Good afternoon. This is Anne Wendland, Cessation Programs Manager for the New York State Department of Health Bureau of Tobacco Control. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, I would like to welcome you to today's call, Integrating Gender Influences into Approaches for Tobacco Cessation. You may view today's presentation in two ways, as a webinar or by downloading the slides posted on the New York State Smokers Quit Line website. The slides and link to the webinar are posted on the collaborative call page of the Quitline website, nysmokefree.com. To access today's presentation, go to nysmokefree.com. On the left side of the page of the website's homepage, there will be a newsfeed section. Directly under this heading is an announcement for today's call. Click on the link provided, and it will bring you to another link for today's presentation. On the same page, under Resources, you will find a list of the New York State Cessation Centers and the respective service areas. Cessation Center staff are available to assist your organization with developing and implementing tobacco dependence treatment policies and clinical protocols. Also for today's webinar, if you're viewing the webinar feature, down in the left-hand corner, you do have a full screen option where you can make the presentation your entire screen, or you can reduce it again. Our featured speaker today is Dr. Joan Batoroff. She's the director of the Institute for Healthy Living and Chronic Disease Prevention and a professor within the School of Nursing at the University of British Columbia. On today's call, Dr. Batoroff will discuss how sex and gender influence smoking in efforts to quit. She will also discuss gender-sensitive and gender-specific interventions to support tobacco reduction and cessation, including how gender influences can be integrated into men-friendly approaches to smoking cessation. Before we start, I have some housekeeping items. We are pleased to offer CME, CRCE, and OASES continuing education credits to listeners of today's presentation. To fulfill the requirements of continuing education credit, we are required to disclose the following. Dr. Batoroff has no real or perceived vested interests that relate to this presentation, nor does she have any relationships with pharmaceutical companies and or other corporations whose products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. To obtain continuing education credit, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms posted on the website. In addition, at the end of the webinar, you can complete the form online if you prefer. Links to the online and paper forms are included in the last slide of Dr. Batoroff's presentation. Please remember, applications for credit will not be accepted after March 13th. That is 1 week from today, so please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible to receive credit. Now it is my pleasure to turn the call over to Dr. Joan Batoroff. Dr. Batoroff?
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for this opportunity to talk with you about this topic, which we think is really important in improving our efforts to reduce and stop smoking among a wide number of groups. So I'm going to just jump in and start. Anne has very nicely described the topics that I want to address this morning, so I won't spend any time on that. And really, I'd like to start perhaps by just clarifying what I mean by sex and gender, because quite often these words are used interchangeably in the literature, and they're actually quite different. So when I refer to sex, I'm referring to the biological concept. And so by this, we can focus on things like hormones and genes and anatomy and physiology. And of course, among males and females, we have significant differences in relation to these characteristics. And we would call these sex-related factors. And these sex-related factors, you know, affect male and female health on a number of diseases, and also they play a role in different responses to treatment. So it's a really important concept and consideration, and we'll talk a little bit later about why it's important in smoking as well. So gender, on the other hand, is really a wide range of socially constructed roles and relationships, attitudes, behaviors, and even relative power and influence that society ascribes to the different sexes on a differential basis. And so it is a multidimensional construct. It's culturally specific. So in different cultures, we may have different roles or expectations for men and women. And these expectations, these attitudes, these behaviors can change over time. So this construct is one that's developed by social scientists. And over the past few years, our thoughts about gender and gender influences continue to develop and become refined, and they're becoming refined. So there's a wide range of issues when we talk about gender influences. So gender roles, for example, is one that we often consider when we talk about gender. And I know that, you know, there's different norms that are applied to males and females. And some of these norms define how we dress, how we behave, the occupations we engage in, the opportunities that people have in front of them, as well as access to many things are defined by gender roles and gender norms. And of course, in most societies, men have a more privileged role in terms of power and control than women, and that also has an effect on health and inequities in society. We also talk about gender identity when we talk about gender, and I'm on slide 6 now. And we refer to masculinities and femininities in this particular construct. And I think these magazines on men's health and women's health reflects how we think of ourselves as women, how we think of ourselves as men, influences perceptions of what a healthy body is and what we might and some of the things that we might do to have a healthy body or a body that is acceptable or pleasing to others in our society. And there are dominant ideals of masculinity and femininity that influence all of us. But there are also different ways that men and women can engage in both masculinities and femininities. We, in the next slide, although we sometimes talk about sex and gender as binary concepts, they're not really. I just talked about sex being a biological construct and thinking about things like hormone levels or muscle mass. You know, that's not a binary. It's actually a continuous variable. And so we're challenged in our research and our programming to think about that. And the same with gender. It's not a binary either in terms of if you think about gender roles, gender identities, and so on. And although sometimes as well we think about sex and gender as completely separate, they actually interact with one another. We have this line that we sometimes use, every cell is sexed, every body is gendered. And so the sex-related factors and gender-related factors that influence our health reside within us. And so we can't easily tease these apart, although we often do focus on them as quite separate. So The best way to integrate them is still under development. It's a challenge for all of us to really think about sex and gender on continuums and how to integrate both sex and gender considerations in our programming. So we're at really an early stage of this, but I did want to just let you know that they're not independent of one another. So on slide 8, you know, if we think about people embodying both sex and gender influences, then it's not unreasonable to think that both sex and gender might have an influence on tobacco use. And that's what our research team has been interested in, as well as other people across Canada and other places, is looking at this relationship between sex and gender and tobacco use and how it might help us understand smoking patterns in a better way, but also how this understanding might inform more effective tobacco reduction interventions. So just to give you some examples of some sex-related factors and their influence on tobacco, and I'm just going to give you a couple of examples today. There's a growing body of research that's suggesting that NRT is less efficacious in women than men. And so we might ask, well, why might that be? And there are a couple of possible explanations. One explanation that actually Karen Lerman in the U.S. has been investigating is related to genetics. And it's women are more likely to have a specific genetic variation that influences the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics of nicotine products. So because of that genetic variation, NRT ends up being less effective for women. There's also a suggestion that sex hormones and also the menstrual phase may also play a role in this, in that estrogen accelerates nicotine metabolism, and females then might need a higher dose of NRT than males to get the same benefit. And so if we're using the same dose for men and women, it might then be part of the explanation about why it's less efficacious. What's interesting, though, is that the non-nicotine pharmacotherapies for smoking cessation at this time don't show any differences between men and women. So it appears to be just related to the nicotine replacements. So as a result of these sex-related factors and perhaps others, it may mean that women might need more intensive smoking cessation interventions, perhaps that are less reliant on nicotine replacement therapies, or as I just mentioned, higher doses of nicotine replacement therapies. But also, there's some research suggesting as well that we might want to consider the follicular phase, or the phase of the menstrual cycle in terms of timing smoking cessation, because the follicular phase might be a more successful time for women to quit smoking. It's also, there's one study in 2000 that suggests even the use of NRT might be timed specifically for women in relation to their menstrual phase. So these are some ways where the sex-related factors might influence what we do in terms of supporting smoking cessation. So what about gender-related factors and tobacco? So because gender is this multidimensional concept, there are a number of ways that we can think about this. So, for example, gender roles influences who smokes, where they smoke, when they smoke, why they might smoke, and so on. So we know, for example, that that because of the occupations that men and women are in might increase their susceptibility to taking up smoking. or the fact that their occupations might make it easier to smoke than others. In terms of gender identities, I would think that you've heard about the masculine cool when it comes to smoking. And sometimes smoking in for women is constructed, at least among young women, as kind of a feminine rebellion. And so gender identities also influence the way people think about smoking and how smoking might be used to enhance the masculinities or femininities that they aspire to and take on. Gender relations is also an interesting in that gendered interactions can also influence smoking patterns. So we know, for example, that women are more likely to resume smoking when they're married to smokers. Yet, the opposite isn't necessarily true, so that women, men are not more likely to resume smoking if their female partners are smoking. So it's interesting. There's obviously some gender dynamics going on there that are influencing relapse that is something we probably need to pay attention to. And also institutionalized gender, and this is how institutional structures and societal practices influence our behaviors. And so, for example, the tobacco industry reproduces very traditional gender norms in their marketing campaigns that influence the uptake of smoking. And also when we think about institutionalized gender inequities, we know that men and women have unequal earning power and that women have less capacity to control exposure. And we know that low-income women end up being exposed, therefore, to often secondhand smoke in a greater way than other kinds of women. So these are just some of the ways that gender-related factors might influence tobacco. In the next slide, this which is slide 12, these images by the tobacco industry I'm sure are familiar to most of you. The Marlboro Man was a very successful marketing campaign positioning smoking as a very manly habit linked to things like freedom, power, and the newer versions of this even try to link smoking to health, I think. And, you know, the Virginia Slims has been equally successful as a marketing campaign, positioning smoking as glamorous and sexy and feminine and so on. Again, rarefying some of those gender identities and luring people into smoking in order to be more manly or more feminine. The modern versions continue. This marketing campaign has been so successful that we see new images. And so clearly, the tobacco industry has figured out that gender is an important part of marketing and that they need to tailor their marketing to both men and women. And so it's interesting that one size doesn't fit all when it comes to the tobacco industry. So we could say then, as in the next slide on number 14, why should one size fit all when it comes to our interventions with tobacco reduction and smoking cessation? So we need to take into account gender-related factors and also those sex-related factors that I talked about earlier. And so there's two strategies we can use. We can try to introduce gender-sensitive approaches that take into account some of the things that we are learning about how gender influences tobacco. And we can also develop gender-specific approaches. So those might be approaches that are specific to men or women or different types of men or women. And sometimes these can be a combination. They can be gender-specific but also gender-sensitive as well. And we do have some examples of that in the next slide. smokefree.gov, the Smoke Free Women website and programming by NIH is a great example of a gender-specific and also gender-sensitive approach to supporting women's smoking cessation. And in Canada, we have a group, and I've been involved in this group, where we did a best practices review on all of the smoking cessation interventions for pregnant and postpartum women. This is an area where we have developed over the years across the world specific programs targeting pregnant women. And some of those programs are more gender sensitive than others, but in this review that we recently completed, we identify some best practices that take into account some of the sex and gender implications, particularly for this target group. And the Canadian Public Health Association has also done some work in terms of developing smoking cessation resources for health providers who work with women. But I also want to share some examples from our own research program where we've attempted to integrate gender considerations into new approaches to tobacco reduction. And this work has grown out of the FACET research project, which stands for Family Control Eliminating Tobacco. And the goals of this research program are listed here. We were really focused on pregnant and postpartum families, and we began with the idea that we wanted to strengthen smoking cessation approaches for pregnant and postpartum women because, as many of you might know, although about half of the women who smoke do reduce and stop quitting during pregnancy, 70% of those women relapse in the first 6 months postpartum. And so we were trying to figure out better ways to support women. And we decided that we needed to look at family dynamics and couple dynamics around smoking because we were interested in how partners supported and undermined women's efforts and if they might be able to be included as part of the approach to supporting women's tobacco reduction, given that health providers can't be interacting with women on a daily basis. We were interested in trying to figure out what supports women had in their own network and whether we might be able to strengthen those supports. We also were interested in looking at domestic space because it's a really ideal opportunity for looking at gender influences in that domestic space. So we conducted interviews with both women and their partners at immediately following pregnancy and then 3 or 4 months into the postpartum period. And we've published several papers off of that. But a couple of the main findings I might just highlight are that we identified tobacco-related routines. As you can imagine, when a woman is smoking in this dyad, and their partners either smoked or didn't smoke, we had both. Smoking gets integrated into everyday activities and routines, and so we were able to describe some of those. We also described what we affectionately call TRIPS, tobacco-related interaction patterns. And these were interaction patterns that we observed between women and their partners that involved tobacco. And I'm not going to really go into the details of these, but what we learned was that these interaction patterns really influenced women's efforts to reduce and stop smoking at this time. And their patterns, these relationship patterns, are often not considered when we have been addressing smoking cessation with pregnant women. As you know, we usually take a very individual approach. You know, this is how you quit smoking, this is what you do. And not really take into account very much people's social network or what's happening in their families. And based on that, we developed this resource, which is shown in slide 20, called Couples and Smoking, What You Need to Know When You're Pregnant. We included this resource, or developed this resource based on our findings to help women understand some of these relationship dynamics and how they might influence their efforts to quit smoking. We used vignettes from some of our interviews to illustrate these. And this booklet, by the way, is available on the smokefree.gov website that I just showed you before. And as far as we know, it's really the only resource that talks about how relationships and relationship dynamics might influence women's tobacco reduction at this time. And so we see it as a useful adjunct to other smoking cessation support for women when they're pregnant. Through this research, we realized that many of the male partners we were talking to were also smokers. And we thought this was kind of curious because you would think that if a woman was reducing and stopping smoking, that it might be a cue to action for her partner. And in fact, many of the partners continued to justify their smoking, at least while their partner was pregnant. And so we began to think about, well, so how many fathers out there do smoke or potential fathers smoke? And is this something we should be paying attention to? And in Canada, as you can see in this graph, men smoke more than women at those age groups, you know, 20 to 34 and 35 to 44 and even 45 to 54. These are all age groups where men might become fathers. And we can see that the smoking rate is higher than women at all of those age groups. We don't actually have statistics on the number of men who smoke during pregnancy, but the chances are that we're going to have some fathers who smoke here. And the statistics in the U.S. from this, the National Health Interview Survey conducted in 2010 and 2011 are not a whole lot different. Again, we see men's smoking rates higher than women's. The age group that smokes the most is 25 to 44. So again, an age group where men might actually become fathers. So what we learned was that few men actually reduced during their partner's pregnancy in the research that we had conducted. And we know in Canada that about 15% of households report daily exposure to a smoker. So we thought, you know, maybe we need to focus some attention on fathers and smoking because we know one of the major relapse factors predicting relapse of women in the postpartum period is actually a partner who smokes. And that's not really probably a big surprise why that might happen. But it is interesting that we've kind of ignored men and fathers in particular at this particular time. So how could we then intervene with men at this time? One of our group, Zim Coley, did a lit review and found 11 intervention studies targeting men for smoking cessation, but only two of those included treatment components specifically for men. One was a group of expectant fathers and one was gay men. The others were just delivered in settings that served men. They were just ordinary smoking cessation programs that you might deliver anywhere, and they were just in venues that where men were located. So, and even these two studies didn't show overwhelmingly positive responses. So we couldn't really get a lot of help from the literature about how we might go about this. So we thought, you know, maybe we really need to spend some time thinking about this and doing some research on it, because if we could figure out how to help fathers reduce and quit smoking at this time, we could support women's efforts to reduce and stop smoking. We could support men's health, maybe prevent a few MIs and prevent cancer. By helping them stop at an earlier age, and of course we could create smoke-free homes for children, which would have all kinds of health benefits. So we set about interviewing men about their smoking, and we learned that smoking was very much tied to masculine identities And this smoke like a man, die like a man is, you know, I think a perfect reflection of that. For many of these men, it defined who they were. They couldn't imagine themselves not smoking. You know, it was the thing that they did with the guys after a hockey game. It was, you know, a glass of beer and a cigarette. Like, how could you have one without the other? And for many men, they had stressful jobs. They used it to deal with the stressful jobs that they had, and sometimes to fit in at work. That was what they had to do, was to smoke. So smoking was really tied up in their work and in their identity in very, very close ways. But we also learned that when men became fathers, although while their partners were pregnant, they would say, you know, smoking has nothing to do with this pregnancy. You know, I'll just smoke outside and, you know, I'm not the one that's pregnant. Once they became fathers, their masculinities began to shift. So instead of this sort of macho, independent, risk-taker masculinities, men then began to take on other masculinities that you might expect of a father, being a protector, a provider, a good role model. And it prompted reflection about what kind of dad they wanted to be. And it was actually heartwarming listening to some of their stories. All of these men that we talked to really aspired to be very good dads. And at least in Western Canada, where we did this study, the image of a good dad is a dad who doesn't smoke. A smoking dad is not seen as a good dad. So because they wanted to be good dads, it began to sort of shake their resolve and began around smoking. They began to raise questions about their smoking. You know, maybe this isn't the best thing. They wanted to be good role models for their children. And they realized they didn't want their children to know them as smoking fathers. And so they began to get motivated sometimes around smoking cessation. But they did tell us that, you know, no one was paying attention to them. And they saw themselves as mostly on their own about this. Their partners, you know, we often think about women looking after men's health, and for the most part, they do a pretty good job of that in many contexts. And so, you know, women who had men in their lives who were smoking were also very concerned about their partner smoking. And they did try to intervene with men. But their coaxing, cajoling, nagging actually, for the most part, didn't help. Men actually wanted to quit on their own terms and do it their own way and decide themselves when they wanted to do it. And they actually didn't appreciate women trying to encourage them to stop smoking. And so what ended up happening was that it created work for women, because women had to continually remind their partners to smoke outside. They had to remind them about putting ashtrays up out of reach of children and so on. And so they didn't really like the fact that they were placed in this position, and they worried very much for the health of their partner. So I think what this told us is we can't depend on women to intervene with men around smoking cessation. Women ended up, as shown in slide 30, they backed off some of that nagging around smoking cessation because it just created tension and anxiety and conflict in the relationship. They needed to preserve this relationship at a time when it was really important to them. They had a new baby. They needed this relationship to support them and taking care of this new baby. And so what they would, in backing off, they positioned smoking as this, oh, well, it's just the thing that men do. It's part of his identity, and, you know, he's a good provider. And if that's all he needs to do, then I'm okay with it. I think I can live with it. So you can see how women had to reposition their ideas about smoking. So we decided we needed to figure out how to intervene with men directly rather than through women. And We wanted to strengthen this beginning motivation that we were seeing in these new fathers around questioning their smoking. And we wanted to push that motivation just a bit further so that men were actually prompted to take the first step to stopping smoking. And so based on our interview data and the advice that fathers gave us, we developed this motivational booklet called The Right Time, The Right Reasons. Dads talk about reducing and quitting smoking. So in this booklet, there's no expert voice. It's actually the voice of fathers. Men told us they wanted to hear the stories of other men. They wanted to support each other in stopping smoking. And we position this book then and pull in narratives from our interviews and the father's voice. In it, we're also trying to support this shift in masculine roles. We believe that these shifting masculinities associated with fatherhood actually are a key motivator to smoking cessation. So we need to capitalize on these. So integrate this gender influence into our approach and make it even stronger. We also wanted to have strength-based messages to support change. So very positive messaging around fatherhood and being a good father and how quitting smoking is part of that. They're not really a message like you need to quit. No shame, no blame reflected in this at all. We included testimonials from some of the men in our interviews, and we tried to have this very kind of masculine look and feel to the resource. I'm not going to show you all the resource, but in this slide you see a few of the pages from this. We wanted to build on this discrepancy that men were starting to experience in relation to smoking and fatherhood. And we did that through a true-false quiz around knowledge about smoking. And we also did it with this personal reflection. I'm a guy who smokes. I'm a guy who wants to quit. And the personal reflection, we hoped, would help augment this discrepancy that they were experiencing with being a smoker and a father, and help them move along that trajectory to stopping smoking. We also developed a group program. The men that we consulted with in our research told us that they wanted a group program so that they could help each other. And so we designed, based on their feedback and suggestions, an 8-week group program for expectant new fathers who want to quit smoking. And this program is called Dads in Gear, or DIG for short. It was run in a fitness center, which is a very positive space for men to be in, as it turned out. They really felt comfortable there. There was a lot of positive energy. This smoking cessation program is unlike most smoking cessation programs that just focus on smoking cessation. We actually included 3 components. We included a component on fathering because we believe that as we support and strengthen engagement in fathering, that men become increasingly motivated to stop smoking and remain smoke-free. And so there was a real strong focus on how to be a better father. And we included various topics and skill building around things that they could do with their children that would enhance their fathering. And that was threaded through every week. We also included an exercise component because men told us that they wanted to be fit to play soccer and football and whatever with their children. But also we know that they told us that they needed to smoke because of the stress of being a new father and of their jobs. And we know that exercise is a good stress reliever. It's one that's acceptable to men, that men are interested in exercise. And so we included an exercise component as well. And this was led by one of the fitness trainers at the gym who put them through their paces. But the exercise we gave them were ones that would engage their children, so it wouldn't necessarily separate them from their children. And so if you think about a weighted ball and doing squats with a weighted ball, the fitness trainer would say, pretend this is your baby, and you can do these at home with your baby, these squats holding your baby. So we tried as much as possible to include children, or the idea of doing exercises with children, in that component. And then finally a tobacco reduction component, where we introduced various topics to men and suggestions about what they might do to reduce and quit smoking. We facilitated some sharing between the participants, and it was up to men to decide what they wanted to do in terms of smoking cessation and when they wanted to quit. We just encouraged them to take advantage of this opportunity. We are now moving to developing, moving some of the resources that we've developed for men onto a website, because we want to make these resources more accessible to men. And we know that not all men might be able to come to a group program because of work commitments and so on. So this work site is to kind of provide a way where men can engage with other men and have access to resources online in a way that they could get support around smoking cessation. So it's still under construction. We're working on this now, and our next steps are to, before I get to that, in this slide, you'll see over the summer we developed 12 YouTube-style videos on various topics that were part of our DIG program, and we are going to incorporate these videos on this website as well. And some of the videos, for example, include narratives of new fathers quitting smoking. Our next steps on slide 37 are to pilot test these new resources, online resources, with men, and to see how they engage with them, and then to make refinements to these before we start going live or distributing the web link in any big way. So that's our next plans around that. So I think there are lots of opportunities to integrate sex and gender into tobacco research or tobacco programming, and I've just gone over a few and highlighted a few of the examples that we're working with. I think we've tried to do this with women's smoking cessation quite a bit, but haven't done it very well with men's smoking cessation, and we're hoping that our work will contribute a bit to that. I think, though, that we can begin to review even our current programs and messages and look at the language in the presentation and also the types of support that are provided. So, for example, in our web-based QUIT program called QUIT Now, that's available in British Columbia, over the past few years, we've noticed that 2/3 of the people that use that web-based resource are women. But we also noticed that it's a lot of pastel colors and a lot of women's photos on it. So maybe that's not too surprising. So over the last few years, the Quit Now group have been revising their website to include, to give it a look and feel that will be appealing to both men and women, and to include more pictures of men as well as women on the website, hoping that this might be at least one small step to attracting more men to the program. The other thing that I think is still a little bit of a deterrent is that you can actually talk to a real person by linking onto this website and requesting a conversation, and the person is called a care coach. I'm not sure a lot of men who smoke will be interested in talking to a care coach. I think we need to change the name to just coach, and it might be more acceptable to men. So sometimes the changes don't need to be that major. Sometimes even just paying attention to these small details and asking ourselves, will this be as attractive to men as it will be to women? We can also develop new resources and programs. And I think there are some groups that we're not reaching very well. And one group that we're particularly interested in is gay men who smoke. We know their smoking rates are very high, and we have a small project underway beginning to try to identify exactly what their needs are and how we might best tailor programs specifically for gay men. So we're doing that through surveys. We're doing it in consultation groups, our focus groups, and hopefully using that information then to figure out how we need to tailor existing smoking cessation programs in ways that will meet their needs. And obviously a source of information is the literature to help us develop these new programs as well. I think that the payoff for including sex and gender is huge. I think that if we start to examine the influence of sex and gender, we have a more complete understanding of health behavior, all health behavior, but in this case, particularly smoking and smoking cessation. I think by integrating sex and gender considerations in our work, we can definitely increase the effectiveness of programs for both men and women. And we can reduce health inequities. So I think what I'd like to do is maybe stop there, and there will be some opportunity. Oh, before I do, I just want to acknowledge the research team that I've been working with. Their names are listed there. Our funding source has been the Canadian Institutes for Health Research, which is similar to your NIH in the U.S., and also the Michael Smith Foundation for Health Research, which is a BC group here. We do have some websites where you can find more information about our work and some of our publications, and we're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you're welcome to follow me on Twitter or Face Tobacco on Twitter as well. And so before I turn to questions and comments, I'm going to turn it over to Pat Bax to provide a few comments about the quitline.
Thank you, Dr. Bator, for that excellent and very informative presentation on quite an interesting topic. I just would like to take a moment to welcome our new and returning participants that are joining us today. And we strongly encourage all of you to join us for future conference calls. If you're not familiar with the New York State Smokers Quitline, we are a free and confidential service. We're evidence-based. We're also located at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York, and we provide help and resources for everyone in New York State. Our clients can access our services through a variety of ways. If someone is a tobacco user and they're seeking help in quitting tobacco use, they can call us directly, they can register online for nicotine replacement therapy, or they can be referred directly through their provider. We offer free coaching, nicotine replacement patches, motivational support, and a wide range of resources that you have probably noticed on our website. And we also have a very robust online community. For providers, we have valuable ready-to-use tools such as our referral program, downloadable materials you can find under the Health Provider and Partners section at our website, nysmokefree.com. And if you're looking for more details, you can contact the Quitline directly at 1-866-697-8487. Related to our topic today, I just want to mention that last year, of the almost 83,000 tobacco users who received direct services from the Quitline, 51% identified themselves as female and 49% as male. And this is pretty consistent data that we've noticed throughout the years. For those women who are pregnant or breastfeeding that contact us, although they do not receive nicotine replacement therapy, they do receive tailored coaching and materials to support them in their quit attempt. And you can find more information on our website under resources, guides, and materials, and fact sheets. Thank you for participating on our call today and for all your assistance in helping your tobacco-using patients to become and stay tobacco-free. At this time, we will open it up for questions. Thank you. Kelly, you can open up the lines.
The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If at any point your question has been answered, you may press 7 again to disable your request. We ask that while using a speakerphone, you please pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. Please hold while we wait for the first question. The first question comes from Madeline Cruz. Madeline, please state your question.
Hi. My question is for the pregnant women. Are they giving an NRTs or are they pregnant?
No, we are not. Through the quit line, we are not able to do so, but we do encourage women that are pregnant to talk to their physicians okay. to discuss this option with them.
Okay. What are after the postpartum?
If they breastfeed? Not if they're breastfeeding, but they can certainly call us once they are no longer pregnant or breastfeeding. But they can certainly call us for support and for coaching, and we do have coaches that will tailor messaging directly to the woman's needs.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
The next question comes from Ann Palmer. Ann, please state your question.
Yes, my question is, I'm wondering if any research has been done on the dynamics between smoking couples as they age. Because I've found that what I end up in my office quite a bit are older couples where the wife or the partner, the female partner smokes, the man does not. And it's a huge source of frustration and aggravation for the man to the point where they're almost ready to end the relationship. Because they don't, for one, they don't want to be the guy who's pushing that woman around in a wheelchair with an oxygen tank. Mm-hmm. And it's a situation where they've said, you know, I told you so kind of situation. Have you done any research on that?
Well, that's a great question, and we haven't, but we do know that the smoking in couples, when one person is smoking in particular, but even when both people are smoking, can be a huge source of tension and conflict. And we haven't specifically, but we know that, and that's partly why when we looked at younger couples, we interviewed couples separately because we weren't wanting to increase women's vulnerability if there was tension and conflict in the relationship around smoking. And that's why we think that interventions for men and women, even in couples like this, shouldn't be couple-oriented. We actually are recommending de-linked interventions, i.e., in these younger couples that we were intervening with, separate interventions for men and separate interventions for women. Although they might be gender-informed, we might be giving information about some of the relationship dynamics, the interventions need to be separate. We think, at first we thought, oh, maybe we can do a family intervention, but we're quite convinced that that's not going to work. And I think from what you're saying, it's not going to work with older couples either.
Well, sometimes actually it has. I've had situations where the partner who doesn't smoke instigated the consult. And
yeah.
So they very much want to come and be there. I've even gone into a couple's home because really it was the husband's, but he wasn't a smoker, but it was his behavior that was driving the wife to continue to smoke. I mean, out of sheer rebellion from him trying to control her.
Yeah. And I think some people might be able to do that. It's just we're not all marriage counselors, so.
Right.
So that's why we haven't necessarily recommended it. But I think some people might be able to offer that kind of support. But I don't think it could be something that we would recommend for a standard approach just
sure.
Because we don't all have the counseling skills that would be required for that, because I think it's very complex.
It is, yes. Thank you.
Next question comes from Kathy Leeson. Kathy, please state your question.
Yes, you address smoking cessation. Do you ever address smokeless tobacco with your couples?
Yeah, that's a good question. None of the... well, I guess it's mostly men who use the smokeless tobacco, but none of the people in our study were using smokeless tobacco. They were all smoking cigarettes. So we haven't specifically addressed it, although we have addressed it in a different study that I haven't reported on. I worked with a PhD student recently, and we did work with in the South Asian community around men who chewed tobacco and betel nut, and looked at some of the dynamics around that and the gender influences, because it was primarily men who were chewing, and their risk for oral cancer. And so from that work, we're beginning to develop some resources to at least increase awareness around this risk factor, and particularly targeting men. So trying to make the information kind of men-friendly and address some of the issues and reasons why men were using the chewing tobacco in this particular context. But we haven't done a lot of work around that in a general sense.
Thank you.
The next question comes from John Corsiniti. John, please state your question.
Oh, hi. It's related to slide number 10. You talk about smoking cessation successes during the different phases. Do you ever recommend that somebody initiate their quit attempt during a certain phase, or do you adjust NRT according to the phase, or was that just sort of a finding?
Well, it's the research results of trials evaluating smoking cessation that's tailored to phases of the menstrual cycle is mixed at the moment, to say the best. That's why I put might be more successful there. So I don't think the jury is out on it, but it's a consideration, I think. And so I think, you know, if we're intervening with women, it might be something that we might want to bring up to them as something they might think about as they reduce and quit smoking. But as I say, the results on the trials are a little bit mixed.
Okay, thanks. Do you also have many patients using the e-cigarette?
Well, actually, in BC, we're actually kind of concerned about the e-cigarette at the moment because it seems to be on the increase, and we haven't quite figured out what to do about that yet. But it is a problem that we're beginning to think we need to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of my quit smoking people all using it, and then using it with the NRT, and it's like, well, now, you know, hard to dose, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Next question comes from Josephine Pottinger. Josephine, please state your question.
Yes, on slide 22, could you please explain why the first area is lower than your the total number for male and female is lower than the 20 to 34 and the 35 and 44. I'm not following. Those were the total number of smokers in the survey, correct?
Yes.
Why is it lower? It should be a much higher
I don't
percentage.
Know.
It's a problem.
I can't explain that.
Unless it's related to something else, and maybe it's a continuation because it says chart 3.
Oh, these are percentages. It's percentages
right on
the...
Yeah, but look, your total percentage is lower than your percentage for 20 to 34-year-olds.
Oh, that's within each age group, I think. These are percentages within the age group.
Okay, so it's an average. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Within the age group, yeah.
All right, fine. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Again, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. The next question comes from Ann Palmer. Ann, please state your question.
Yes, I just have one more question. Has there been any research into gender differences or sex differences in smokers who have mental health complications?
Oh, yeah, as you know, the smoking rates among the mentally ill are also very high.
Yes.
And it's a group that we haven't really paid a lot of attention to. I think the assumption has been that they're not interested in smoking cessation, which is not true.
That's not true,
absolutely. No. And the other, of course, complicating factor there is that tobacco has been used to modify behavior.
Yes.
And sometimes in counseling, I think, to engage patients in counseling sessions. So, yeah, so I don't know of any studies that have looked at sex and gender differences in that group. I know that there have been some studies, and you probably know this as well, that some of the medications that patients are on, that smoking seems to mitigate some of the side effects of some of those medications. I think, you know, some of the things when it comes to responses to nicotine replacement therapies that we know are different in terms of men and women in the general population would also apply to the mentally ill. Whether there are differences in uptake among men and women, I'm not entirely sure. I suspect that it's probably pretty similar, but I don't know that. Because quite often people will go in to mental health services with not being smokers and after a while come out smokers.
Yes, especially when institutions use them as rewards.
Yes, yeah, and that's still happening, unfortunately.
Yes, it is.
I think it is.
It is. It absolutely is. Well, thank you very much. Yes.
We have smoke-free hospitals and obviously mental health units now, but even still, some institutes have implemented fresh air breaks, but fresh air breaks are really breaks to go outside for smoking.
For smokes.
And so it's interesting that we call them fresh air breaks.
Fresh air breaks. That's typical of tobacco advertising, actually.
Yeah, it is.
Call it, name it exactly what it isn't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Good point.
Thank you.
Again, if you do have a question, please press the number 7.
Well, it's past 1 o'clock, so I think we can close this conversation. If you have other questions, feel free to email them to Dr. Batorov so she can respond. I just want to let you know that the next webinar will be on May 1st. The start time, again, will be 12 p.m. Sarah Bodner with the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene will discuss meaningful use in the Affordable Care Act. On behalf of the New York State Department of Health Bureau of Tobacco Control, the Tobacco Cessation Centers, and the New York State Smokers Quitline, I want to express our appreciation for the excellent presentation today and thank all of you who participated in today's call. I added the link for the survey onto the end of or into the chat box, and it is within the last slide of Dr. Batorov's presentation as well. This will bring us to the end of our call. Please be sure to fill out the evaluation and have a great rest of your day. Thank you.
This does conclude today's teleconference. We thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.